Israel and Hezbollah agree to renew their ceasefire in Lebanon after that conflict delays peace talks aimed at a permanent end to the U.S. war with Iran. It is Friday, June 19th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead this hour, we mark this Juneteenth holiday with a look at the history of the Emancipation Proclamation.
Most enslaved people have to wait for Union troops to get to them to sort of liberate them.
Also, Becky Sullivan will get you up to speed on today's U.S.-Australia World Cup match. And speaking of the World Cup, Scotland fans have hit Boston with a vengeance.
People call it an invasion, but I think they've actually come here to wrap their arms around us and lift us up to celebrate with them.
Yeah, Boston bars ran out of beer for the first match. How the Tartan Army drank Boston dry. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Libby Casey. Secretary of State Marco Rubio says another round of talks between Israel and Lebanon will be held next week in Washington, D.C. This will be the fifth round of direct political talks between the two sides and will take place at the State Department. NPR's Jackie Northam reports.
Secretary Rubio held a phone call with Lebanese President Joseph Aoun, during which he reiterated the need to disarm the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah and reestablish control over all Lebanese territory. That's according to a State Department readout of the conversation. Hezbollah has in the past rejected any peace deal between Israel and the government of Lebanon. Rubio also stressed that bilateral negotiations between Lebanon and Israel represent the only feasible path to ending recurrent cycles of violence. Meanwhile, Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to a ceasefire after intense fighting threatened to derail fragile peace talks between the U.S. and Iran. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
The Russian military says its air defenses destroyed several dozen Ukrainian drones on approach to Moscow today. The intercepts come a day after Ukraine launched a massive wave of drone attacks on the Russian capital. NPR's Charles Maines has more.
Ukrainian drones' primary target Thursday appeared to be Moscow's main oil refinery, with several striking storage tanks causing explosions. The one reported fatality, an 8-year-old girl, came when a drone struck an apartment high-rise nearby. Russian President Vladimir Putin has yet to comment directly on the attacks, yet his spokesman Dmitry Peskov praised the performance of the city's air defenses, saying they'd been robust, despite complaints from city residents of no official warning as the drones approached. Peskov also urged the public to ignore the dramatic pictures of plumes of smoke over Moscow shared widely online, saying people should instead search for images of the damage inflicted by Russian missiles on Ukraine. Charles Maines, NPR News, Moscow.
The $400 million luxury plane given to the U.S. by Qatar last year was unveiled today as the newest Air Force One. President Trump's acceptance of the jet triggered bipartisan questions about security risks and conflicts of interest. Evanston, Illinois celebrated Juneteenth today with its annual Walk for Freedom. The 2.5-mile walk symbolizes the 2.5 years it took for news of the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863 to reach enslaved people in Texas. The march also honors the legacy of Opal Lee, who helped lead the movement to make Juneteenth a federal holiday. She's now 99 years old. Evanston's parade was marshaled by her granddaughter, Dion Sims.
We were both there on June 17, 2021, when President Biden signed the Juneteenth Independence Day Act into law.
Opal Lee was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom by President Biden in 2024. This is NPR News. At last check, the American team is ahead of Australia in its World Cup match 2-0, despite playing without star Christian Pulisic, who sat out with a calf injury. Defender Alex Freeman scored the second goal for USA just before halftime. The first goal was an own goal by Australia. Two of the FIFA World Cup favorites are back in action this weekend, as are two of the newcomer nations to the tournament. NPR's William Jones reports.
Four-time World Cup winner Germany will play Ivory Coast after thumping newcomers Curaçao in their opening game. And for Curaçao, the Caribbean island nation, who played with real tenacity for much of that 7-1 loss to Germany, they'll be hoping for a change of fortune as they play Ecuador. On Sunday, European champion Spain will look to build some momentum to their World Cup campaign. They go up against Saudi Arabia. Spain has had to regroup after a surprise tie against World Cup newcomers Cape Verde. And for Cape Verde, who captivated global audiences with that stunning underdog performance, they'll now play Uruguay, who won the first ever World Cup some 96 years ago. William Jones, NPR News.
For the first time in more than 200 years, visitors to the Acropolis in Athens can see the Parthenon's western side looking intact. A restoration effort unveiled yesterday shows two new marble blocks filling gaps on the temple's western end. It's the first view visitors see when they arrive at the ancient monument, which is 25 centuries old. The project was funded through a European Union program. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Bayer, who believes science is the relentless process of asking questions, testing, and trying again, even when it's not easy. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. This is NPR.
It is 4:06, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. KXE, KBXE, Bridget's Pub, and King & Cork host the Beltrami Block Party in downtown Bemidji Saturday, June 27th, starting at 1 p.m. Free live music with Eric Koskinen, David Huckfelt, Little Fevers, and more, as well as food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. Info at KAXE's Facebook page. Made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Today was supposed to be a lot of things. The Vice President, J.D. Vance, was supposed to be in Lucerne, Switzerland. He was supposed to be there to kick off a 60-day negotiation period between the U.S. and Iran, 60 days with the goal of bringing a final end to the U.S. war with Iran. Those things did not happen. What did happen? More fighting between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. That fighting led to the negotiations in Switzerland being postponed. And while things seem to have quieted for now, Israel has promised to attack again if they feel provoked. Well, just a few hours into the ceasefire, we wanted to check on Lebanon to see if this delicate agreement is actually holding. So we have reached Mohammed El-Shama, a Beirut-based reporter for The Washington Post. Mohammed, welcome.
Hi there.
Hi. So let's start with a quick status check. This ceasefire in Lebanon was supposed to start at around 4 p.m. your time. I know it's now late into the night there. Is it quiet? Like, what can you see and hear?
So Beirut's pretty much really quiet. There's no sound of drones overhead. And the rest of the country is also pretty quiet, although there is like an air of caution prevailing, mm-hmm. more like a wait and see.
But that is in stark contrast, it sounds like, to earlier today. I mean, the sequence of events, as I understand them today, is that Israel was striking Hezbollah targets across southern and eastern Lebanon, striking them hard. And then as the day unfolded, they agreed to a renewed ceasefire. Why?
So what happened was overnight, Israel attacked a group of Israeli soldiers, killing four, mm-hmm. and Israel responded with like a massive bombardment in South Lebanon and East Lebanon. That led to more than 40 deaths. And then it really felt like, you know, the ceasefire would collapse and we'd be back into war. But miraculously, a ceasefire negotiated by the U.S., and we're told it was negotiated by the U.S., Iran, and Qatar, sort of took place, and that kind of calmed things down. But it really felt like things would get out of control. But in the meantime, that I'm told that sort of led the Iranians to postpone the talks in Switzerland today.
Yeah. I mean, so you're giving us a few new pieces of information there. One, that Qatar was involved in helping broker this Lebanon ceasefire, that the U.S. was involved. I guess bigger picture.
And Iran.
How closely linked are this renewed ceasefire in Lebanon and the ceasefire, the U.S.-Iran ceasefire that's just been renewed that they're hoping to build on to try to end the Iran war?
So the U.S. really wants the Lebanon ceasefire to work, mainly because there's a lot that hinges on it, specifically the talks with Iran, which, you know, if that goes south, then we'd be back into, you know, a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz and all that, and all the work that went into place to reach the big MOU, that would be squandered. So they really want this to work, and this is kind of different from like the last ceasefire that Lebanon and Israel agreed to. They didn't really have buy-in from Iran. This time they do. And this time the U.S. is kind of making sure that the U.S. Israel sticks by the ceasefire. I mean, today a lot of Israeli cabinet ministers, they really wanted like a heavy bombardment, and it really looked like we were headed in that direction. But it appears that the U.S. Is keeping things quiet here. So, yeah.
When you say the U.S. is keeping things quiet, the U.S. is putting pressure on Israel to adhere to a Lebanon ceasefire. Do we know how? Like, what is the U.S. actually saying, and what may be happening behind the scenes?
So I don't have much information on that yet, but do you know that the Iranians kind of want to preserve, they want to make sure that Lebanon isn't attacked, because they do have a lot of supporters in Lebanon. And in the last war, Iran kind of didn't do much to prevent, like that in the 2024 war, they kind of didn't do much to prevent that war from unfolding. So there was a lot of criticism in Lebanon against Iran. This time they kind of want to like show that, hey, we're here and we kind of support our Hezbollah partisans and stuff.
Yeah. We have less than a minute left, but big picture, how solid does this Lebanon ceasefire feel?
I'm hopeful. I mean, initially, so it did go into effect at around 4 local time. There were some reported strikes here and there, but it seems to be holding so far. I feel like because Iran is on board and because the U.S. is willing to kind of hold back Israel, that I do feel like this might work out. But again, we'll have to wait and see.
Well, I am wishing you a quiet night and thanking you for your time staying up to talk to us. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mary Louise.
That is Mohammed El-Shama of The Washington Post speaking with us from Beirut. Today is Juneteenth. That is the day that marks the arrival of Union troops in Galveston, Texas, at the close of the Civil War. They had come to enforce President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which more than 2 years earlier had ordered that enslaved people in Confederate states be freed. This year, we're taking a look at that moment in history and how news of freedom spread through the grapevine across the South. NPR's Scott Newman has more.
Once Lincoln issued his proclamation, white Southerners were anxious to keep the explosive news of his executive order from the ears of their slaves. But as Lincoln historian Harold Holzer says, since enslaved people were prohibited from reading or writing, some assumed they wouldn't learn of their own freedom.
They also assumed that they were oblivious to conversation. And the truth was they weren't.
Holzer is director of the Roosevelt House Public Policy Institute at Hunter College in New York.
There was undoubtedly talk around households in the Confederate South that Lincoln had issued what they thought was an outrageous, illegal, race war fomenting order.
The Emancipation Proclamation took effect on January 1st, 1863. It was the one most of us learned about in history class, but it actually wasn't the first. Lincoln issued a preliminary version in September 1862. So the move had been telegraphed. White Southerners and many enslaved black people alike knew it was coming. Here's Kelly Carter Jackson, chair of Africana Studies at Wellesley College.
Word spreads fast. So for people who know that this is happening, literally at midnight on January 1st, 1863, there are enslaved people that are like ready to party.
But actual freedom took more than a proclamation from the North. Blair L. M. Kelly is director of the National Humanities Center and author of a recent book on the history of Juneteenth. She says that right from the early stages of the war, whenever Northern troops pushed south, slaves were poised to bolt to freedom.
I think the idea for most of the enslaved was that if the Union comes, you are free.
So while the news was not entirely new to many slaves in Galveston on June 19, 1865, Juneteenth endures because it marks the moment that the rumors of freedom finally became reality. Scott Newman, NPR News.
Scottish soccer fans have taken over Boston.
Run away, run away. No Scotland, no party.
That that is the Tartan Army, as they're called, celebrating at the wine and beer garden, The Anchor. The fans brought their Scottish traditions with them to watch the World Cup. So, yes, kilts, yes, bagpipes, and yes, drinking. Lots of it.
I will usually drink about 15 beers a night. And, we just like to party.
That is Scottish fan Ian Haggerty speaking to local TV station WCVB. The drinking? Well, when the team played its first game last Saturday, several Boston bars ran short on beer. Billy DeCane, general manager of the Sam Adams Tap Room in downtown Boston, told Reuters,
"We're all running out of beer, and the local distributors are just doing what they can to get them in, and I know a lot of them got shipments in, and it seems like the Scottish pride themselves in having places like just drinking them dry."
City Hall has Scotland Fever 2 this week. Mayor Michelle Wu started the process to make Boston and Glasgow sister cities.
The Scottish army invasion is real, the Tartan Army. And I say that people call it an invasion, but I think they've actually come here to wrap their arms around us and lift us up to celebrate with them.
That is Mike Morrison. He met some Scottish fans last week. They were staying in an Airbnb across the street.
They came complete with decorations, seemingly in the dead of night. And my wife noticed it first thing in the morning and sort of called my attention to it. It wasn't long after that. I'd say a little after 6:30 in the morning, we heard the bagpipes going, and I happened to be on the front lawn.
Oh my God, 6:30 in the morning. That is Morrison's video embracing his new neighbors. It went viral on social media. Now, I don't know if I would appreciate hearing bagpipes that early, but Morrison went over to meet the group.
They were gracious enough to invite me back to their Airbnb for a couple of cold drinks and some good talk, and we had plenty of laughs, and certainly I consider them friends now.
The Scots have left the Airbnb by now, but Morrison now calls himself an adopted Scot. When we caught him earlier today, he was on his way to Scotland's match against Morocco.
Never in my wildest dreams did I think I'd be sitting here in a vehicle wearing a kilt with a Scottish sticker on my face headed in.
Well, after today's match, watch out Miami. That is where Scotland heads next to face Brazil.
And even if we don't win, we will win, we will win. We'll be key on in Boston.
In Boston, in Boston.
No Scotland, no party. Steve Clark's Tartan Army. They talk of France in 98 and all the years we've had to wait to make another World Cup. Things are finally looking up. It's always been a dream a generation's never seen. That's how long it has been. But now if Nate's hammer here, there should be nobody that we fear. Beat the Danes along the way, doesn't it matter?
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 18 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is your Daily Dose of Phenology, where John Latimer looks back at his nature notes from the state. We receive support from Sanford Bemidji Family Medicine Team, providing care to the whole family from birth to the golden years. More at bemidji.sanfordhealth.org. Now it's time for your Daily Dose of Phenology with John Latimer.
On today's date, June 19th in 1996, the first showy lady slippers had come up and flowered. We have four different distinct varieties of lady slippers in the northern part of the state, and the showy lady slipper is the state flower, and it is easily discerned from the other lady slippers by the presence of white sepals. So if you look at any other lady slipper, I don't care what color the flower is, it can be yellow, it can be pink, it can be white, but the sepals on anything other than a showy lady slipper are going to be green or bronze or mahogany. They're not going to be white. So if you're looking at a lady slipper and it has white petals and white sepals, then you're looking at the showy lady slipper. You could be looking at a white lady slipper, and instead of having white sepals, it would have green or greenish sepals. So the showy lady slipper is our state flower, and it has the white sepals. That's how you tell them apart. You might also note this about the showy lady slipper, and that is that handling it can sometimes cause a reaction like poison ivy, because there are little hairs all over the plant, and sometimes those hairs can be an irritant to the skin.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Rolaids, containing a dual active formula with the goal of neutralizing acid in seconds for heartburn relief. Rolaids spells relief. Learn more at Rolaids.com. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Scott Detrow, here with another edition of Spacing Out with our friends from Shortwave, Regina Barber and Burley McCoy. Hey there.
Hey.
Hey, Scott.
So what are we talking about today within space?
Yeah, Scott, we're talking about little transforming robots on the moon.
Okay.
Also, some drama in the astronomy world about how our universe is expanding.
Okay.
And lastly, we have to, of course, talk about the Artemis 2 and 3 crews and how they trained for future missions to land on the moon.
Well, before we talk about that, I guess I need to know whether there are Transformers on the moon, because I do feel like I've seen that movie.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Scott. We're not talking about Optimus Prime landing on the moon. These are small, like cute little round robots about the size of a baseball. Hmm. And they roll out of a lunar lander. And after cracking open, like down the middle, each half of the sphere moves outward and it reveals a little camera in the center. And the halves kind of act like spinning wheels and they kind of waddle and roll over hard terrain. And these little rovers, they're autonomous too. They basically navigate on their own.
This seems so cool. I mean, like, I love the image.
Yeah. Yeah.
The autonomy is interesting. I do have to ask, why were they there?
Well, mostly for testing. They were part of the first successful Japanese lunar landing a couple years ago. And there's a new study out last week in the journal Science Robotics that analyzed how these little guys performed up on the lunar surface.
Other than kind of waddling around and seeming like Wall-E characters, what was their scientific job?
So they took a lot of pictures of the moon's surface and of the lander. They're basically scouting out the terrain ahead of bigger rovers and going places they can't.
And Scott, just to underline this, they're really small. They only weigh about a half a pound. And that's huge for space travel, right? The lighter something is, the easier and cheaper it is to put up into space.
And I talked to Roger Weens, a planetary scientist who didn't work on this program, and he was thoroughly impressed. He said that the redundancy was a huge benefit to these devices.
These are not expensive devices. You can have several of them. And if one or two fails, then you still have others.
One other thing, though, I'm thinking about the fact that the moon has 1/6 of the Earth's gravity.
Yep.
So does that affect how they move around?
Totally. Yeah. These little guys actually kind of bounce, though.
Oh.
So it's another reason why they're super cool. They're designed for low gravity so they can explore other places like Mars or even asteroids. Here's Roger again.
These could go to small asteroids where hopping is extremely easy. In fact, you got to make sure you don't hop out of orbit or something like that. So, yeah, I can see these things going to a number of places. We'll have transformers on various planets and asteroids eventually.
Okay, this was a really fun start. We need to shift to something much more existential, though, for all of us, and that is our ever-expanding universe. First of all, remind us what this debate has focused on over recent decades.
Okay, so Scott, almost 30 years ago, astronomers discovered that our universe is not only expanding, but that expansion is speeding up. But in the last few years, a group of scientists shook up that understanding by claiming that the expansion isn't speeding up, but slowing down. Now, a paper out last week in the journal Monthly Notices of the Royal Astronomical Society pushes back and says the old framework still stands, continuing the debate.
So we're back to expanding.
Expanding and accelerating.
Okay. So given that we're back to that point of view, what do the expansion of the universe is slowing down, folks, say to that?
The group of scientists at Yonsei University in South Korea stands by their work. They already posted a rebuttal to this paper, and they say that the standard way astrophysicists measure universe expansion now is fundamentally flawed.
So for the non-astrophysicists out there, remind us how you measure this.
I'm going to let Burley do this.
Okay.
Yeah, so astronomers basically measure the brightness of a special type of exploding star, a supernova, and then correct for things like how long it explodes or how much dust is in the way.
And the South Korean team has said, astronomers, we haven't been including the age of the star's home galaxy in those corrections, so the math is off. And when you include that, the final answer is that the expansion of the universe is slowing down. which would be a massive discovery if that were true.
This is quite the big if true.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so given all of that, though, what is the consensus among other astronomers?
So the experts we spoke to were skeptical of the slowdown hypothesis. They say the community has been fine-tuning the supernova method for almost 30 years, and there are other methods that point to the universe's expansion speeding up.
Yeah, we talked to Priyamvada Natarajan, an astrophysicist from Yale University, who wasn't involved in this work, and she's still skeptical, but she says these kind of debates are what strengthen science.
Scientists by nature are skeptical. And even for an idea that has been validated and accepted, right, if there is a new argument, we do take it seriously and we interrogate it.
And it's a low-stakes debate, right? Because it's only just like the fate of the universe that's at stake.
Instead of everything eventually drifting far apart from each other and dying a cold death billions of years from now, the universe could simply implode, what astronomers call the Big Crunch. Sadly, none of us are going to be around to see that.
I'm team cold death.
I don't know which one I prefer.
Hard to choose, huh?
Yeah, non-issue for me, I guess. Something that is happening in our time spans, though.
Yeah.
Our favorite NASA program, Artemis. We've got to talk about it.
Totally. The crew for the next mission, Artemis 3, was just selected. And this is the mission that will do lots of maneuvers in space, in low Earth orbit. Scott, you spoke with one of the newly selected astronauts, right?
I did. The day he was selected, I talked with Andre Douglas, and one of the things he talked about was going on training missions. He was on the backup crew for Artemis 2, and
yeah.
He trained alongside them. And
yeah.
One of the things they did was go to Iceland.
We did a 24-mile hike in 2 days in Iceland just to go through a hard challenge of land navigation as if we're, you know, learning how to be really good operators.
And they do this, you know, as you know, because this mission is supposed to help prepare them for future lunar explorations. So they're looking for places on Earth that are kind of analogs of the moon, of lunar conditions.
Yeah, and it's also about geology. Like, the rocky terrain and the actual rock compositions are very similar between the moon and Iceland. Apollo astronauts actually trained in Iceland, too, way back when, and said it was the closest thing they had seen to the moon's surface. Two NASA astronauts are going back there this July to train in Iceland.
And this isn't just for lunar missions, right? They're actually, NASA's, it's farther away, but they're trying to simulate Mars as well right now?
Yeah.
Yeah, so they've had astronaut hopefuls trek around the lava beds in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park with big packs on their backs, doing geological field work and dealing with very limited and very delayed communications from a simulated mission control. It's all a way to make sure our astronauts are super well prepared when someday they are out in space doing the real thing. And Scott, there is a simulated Mars mission happening right now at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston. NASA has four researchers in this 3D printed habitat doing experiments as if they're living on Mars. They went in last October and they'll stay inside for a little over a year. And maybe, we'll come back and talk about that when they emerge.
Sounds great. That is Regina Barber and Berlin McCoy of NPR Science Podcast, Shortwave. Thank you for coming into our simulated Earth environment of this NPR radio studio.
Thank you.
Anytime.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 4:29, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE, KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is National Native News. We receive support from Bridget's Pub, located in downtown Bemidji, serving Irish and American food, offering Monday night trivia at 6:30 and open mic night on Thursday starting at 6:30. More on Facebook. After Dark is our late-night Saturday show outside the normal KAXE mix. Tune in after Green Cheese at 9 p.m. to hear punk, hip-hop, electronic, metal-themed shows, and more. This week's host, Jay Steelwolf, will be playing heavy metal. And we receive support from Hibbing Chrysler Center, serving northern Minnesota. Carrying Chrysler, Dodge, Jeep, and Ram vehicles with staff available to assist. On the Beltline in Hibbing or at hibbingchrysler.us. The Grand Rapids MS Support Group meets the second Thursday of each month from 11 to 12:30 in the meeting room at IM Hotel. Open to all. Now for National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas.
For me, this is freedom. The freedom to let people know what really happened. And it's important for me to tell the story so we can move forward for everyone. Oh, I'm ready.
For many Native people, the version of California history taught in school doesn't tell the whole story. For Brad Manoa, the inspiration for a new 10-part docuseries, People of the West, came after learning about a California history presentation at his son's school. Manoa says Native American history received only a brief mention, while much of the focus was placed on a version of California history that overlooked Native voices and experiences. That moment sparked an idea.
So I wanted to make a series that would reach the youth in a compelling cinematic way, the dramatic recreations, beautiful animations when we couldn't depict something in real life. And then one of the biggest archival libraries of stills and video of California history that I think exists on the planet. And we put all that together in 10 one-hour episodes. And I'm telling you, it's amazing.
Manoa, a citizen of the Pechanga Band of Indians, says the series, which took over 2 years to create, also touches on his family's own experiences. One scene was inspired by the love story of his grandparents. He says his grandfather was afraid to tell his future wife that he was Native because of the prejudice Native people faced at the time. Years later, watching actors bring that story to life on screen left him in tears.
I just started crying and sobbing. I explained that that scene was from my family history specifically, and, you know, it was an honor to have them portray it.
Manoa says the series isn't just about the past. He hopes Native people see themselves reflected in stories that have often been overlooked, and that viewers leave with a deeper understanding of California's First Peoples.
I just want everybody who watches the series to come away with a new, profound understanding of history from the Native perspective. I'm almost 100% sure that if they just watch with an open mind, it will inform all of their decision-making going forward in a good way so that we can build a better future for our kids.
While the project has generated interest, Manoa says it has not yet been picked up by a streaming service. He says that's intentional.
We made the whole thing on spec without pre-selling it to a studio. When you do that, yes, you get funding, but you also get oversight. And the studios get to determine final cut and get to suggest taking things out, adding stuff in. But we wanted to tell the story without those handcuffs. So we made the whole thing on spec without pre-selling it. And now that we have it, we're trying to find distribution.
Completing the project came with sacrifices. Manoa says work often took him away from his family. Now that the series is finished, he says he's looking forward to making up for lost time and being more present with the people who supported him throughout the journey.
My wife has shouldered a lot of the responsibilities at home in her effort to support me, but she's been neglected. My kids have been neglected. They call me the dad from Hook. As a joke, before he goes to Neverland and Hook, he's kind of all consumed with work and on his phone. So I want to balance that all back and be there with my kids and my wife and tend to our land on the reservation.
The 10-part series makes its world premiere June 20th at the TCL Chinese Theater in Hollywood as part of the Dances with Films Festival. Manoa says he hopes audiences leave the theater with a deeper understanding of California's Native peoples and the stories that helped shape the state. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Colorado Plateau Foundation, supporting Native-led initiatives, protecting plateau lands, waters, and cultures by building networks, community, and organizational capacity. Grant proposals accepted through September 4th at ColoradoPlateauFoundation.org.
Support by Sanofsky Chambers Law, championing tribal sovereignty and Native American rights since 1976, from opioids litigation to treaty rights to tribal self-governance, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska. Sanofsky Chambers Law.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Penn Medicine, committed to innovation since 1751. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine is working to change lives. From Bank of America, sponsor of the FIFA World Cup 2026, dedicated to offering solutions to help businesses win, locally and globally. More at bankofamerica.com/gamechangers. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Most American workers can blow the whistle to an independent agency if they face sexual harassment or discrimination on the job. But people who work for the federal courts are different. They don't have those same rights. A group of law students is asking the Supreme Court to weigh in on this. NPR Supreme Court correspondent Carrie Johnson met a few of them.
Law schools often push students to work for the federal courts in prestigious jobs as interns or clerks. But those students can get a harsh surprise when they learn judges exercise near total control over their hours, holidays, and work culture. There's no clear way to complain or sue outside that system.
You may not know as a student entering a clerkship that you're going to forego certain workplace protections that you otherwise would never have to even consider foregoing because they just seem that fundamental.
That's Sophia Bettini. She just graduated from Emory Law School in Atlanta. Many of her friends and colleagues expect to work in the court someday. So the plight of clerks, probation officers, and public defenders who work for the judicial branch caught her attention.
They have nowhere to turn, no independent enforcer, no neutral decision maker, and there exists a very real threat that speaking up will cost them everything.
Bettini and her fellow law students recently petitioned the U.S. Supreme Court to take up the case of a former federal public defender who says she faced sexual harassment on the job. The students volunteer with the Supreme Court Advocacy Program at Emory. Professor Paul Koster says it's the only student-led Supreme Court litigation program in the country.
These students are getting credits for this. They're not getting graded on this. They're doing the work because they want to do the work.
And he says it's a lot of work. 10 law students spent weeks digging into the facts and the law. At the center of the case is the unique system the courts use to police themselves and whether it gives workers due process and equal protection under the law. Student Andrew Taramekin says the judiciary is a special place.
Yes, it's a huge employer, but in many ways it's a small community.
Taramekin will enter his third and final year of law school in the fall. He spent hours researching a fundamental civil rights law known as Title VII for that Supreme Court petition.
Title VII goes back to the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and it prohibits certain unlawful workplace conduct that includes what we generally understand as workplace harassment, workplace discrimination.
By 1995, lawmakers had passed a new law to extend those protections to workers in Congress. And Taramekin says by his read, Congress intended federal court employees to get protections too. But lawmakers wanted to give the judiciary wide berth to execute on them. Every federal circuit court has since developed its own HR program for workers to resolve disputes. But in all of them, judges tend to oversee complaints against people they know and might work with every day. The Emory law students say that's not the kind of neutral, independent decision-making that's promised in the civil rights law. Again, Sophia Bettini.
Autonomy for the institution cannot come at the cost of basic workplace rights and safety for people within it.
Karen Strickland, the former public defender who says she faced harassment at work, says the problems with the system will only be fixed if the legal community is willing to stand up against a serious injustice. A spokesman for the Administrative Office of the Courts in Washington declined comment on the case, but that office has been defending the judiciary's internal system as robust. They say changes are coming to make it easier to report wrongdoing. The Supreme Court has asked the Justice Department for a response to the students' petition, and it's due next month. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
Today marks a major milestone for Chicago's South Side as the Obama Presidential Center officially opens to the public. Some supporters view the center as a welcome investment in a historically underserved community, while some community members worry it could accelerate gentrification and force longtime residents out of the neighborhood. From member station WBEZ, Araceli Gomez Aldana is at the public opening. She joins us now. Hey, Araceli.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty well. Tell us where you are, exactly what you see, how the community is reacting to the public opening.
You know, it's a beautiful day in Chicago. It is busy. There's a lot of energy. Hundreds of people are here. I've spoken to locals and people from out of town. It is Juneteenth, the holiday, so a lot of people were here early. Mm-hmm. I will say there was traffic, a little, you know, it was a little tricky to get here, but overall people are excited. They are happy to talk to us. I've been hearing how proud Chicagoans are to have this center right here in their hometown. I spoke to Florence James. She lives in the area and she thinks the center will reinvigorate residents.
Everything just been lying dormant. It hasn't been a lot of traffic for years. And because this is here, it just created a staple where we can come and have quality instruments like computers, studios in there, working rooms so we can actually get what we need done and still be inspired.
Well, and Araceli, they've had a lot of time to get ready for this. This project has been, what, many years in the making?
That's right. The center was projected to open in 2021, but was delayed due to lawsuits and budget overruns.
Budget overruns. Tell me about some of the twists and turns in that whole process.
Yeah, you know, there's been a lot. I remember actually last year or 2 years ago around this time, former President Barack Obama paid a visit to the area to mark a construction milestone. He spent time thanking architects and construction workers, but he was also met by protesters. And these protesters, they want to express their concerns over the center's construction, how it could lead to long-term residents being priced out of the surrounding neighborhoods. And that tension has been growing since the center was proposed back in 2016.
Talk me through that tension, because there does also seem to be a lot of excitement around it, like supporters thinking, hey, this center could really help the neighborhood.
Yeah, I spoke to residents and they view the center as a major investment in a community that they feel has experienced decades of disinvestment. They point to potential benefits, including job creation, increased tourism, and improvements to infrastructure. We are seeing some of those signs already, things like roads being fixed, city investment to capital projects, $2 million to extend public transport to help people get here. So lots of changes like that, which are already visible around the neighborhood. And I think overall, many residents just hope that the project will generate opportunities so that they that have been lacking in this area for years.
And then speak to the other piece of it, the tension about affordability.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, it's a big concern for a lot of people in the area. Right now, this tension has been growing since you know, years, decades. We have the University of Chicago very close by, so the campus already affects the affordability of the area. I will say that the Obama Foundation did spend a lot of time talking to residents and hearing concerns from community members as the center was, you know, being constructed. But ultimately, the activists were demanding for Community Benefits Agreement, a CBA. It's a legally binding contract, but the agreement was never reached.
And in just a sentence or two, what are you watching for? Or what are you monitoring going forward?
I think residents are going to be closely watching whether this actually does promise some economic opportunities. And hopefully it's felt by local families and businesses here.
WBEZ reporter Araceli Gomez Aldana reporting from Chicago. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered this Friday afternoon here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is North Star Stories. We receive support from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community for the community. There's a new support group for families impacted by substance abuse Wednesdays at 5:30 at Essentia Health in Virginia. Find a space that's authentic, safe, and supportive. Meetings are in the boardroom. Enter through the urgent care door. And we receive support from ICTV, providing information for and about Itasca County on Apple TV, Roku, and watchictv.org. The Grand Rapids Area Library Fund has been established at the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation. The goal is to open the library at least one more day per week in 2027. Find more info at gracf.org.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
With a special edition of North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston. All this week, we've examined what political violence took from Minnesota, what it changed, and why the people it touched say the answer is not to walk away from public service, but to make it more human. Political threats and violence are on the rise. Earlier this week, almost exactly a year after an assassin killed Speaker Emerita Hortman and her husband, officials charged a 49-year-old man with threatening St. Paul's mayor. For our final report, we turn to Republican House Speaker Lisa Damoth, who shared leadership of an evenly divided House with Melissa Hortman and now leads the chamber. As Tracy Collier reports, Damoth says Hortman led the House with a bipartisan approach.
As elected officials, we set the tone, so how we carry ourselves matters.
Republican House Speaker Lisa Damoth says political leaders cannot control every act of violence, but they can control the language they use, the example they set, and whether they treat political opponents as enemies.
I believe that the way people talk with each other and to each other when we disagree on issues has actually gotten worse in the last year.
1 year after political violence took former House Speaker Melissa Hortman's life, Damoth says Hortman's own leadership offers a response to the worsening culture. When Hortman led the majority in 2023, she called Damoth, who was the new minority leader,
and said, let's meet together weekly. And Democrats at that point had full control of state government. So my votes weren't needed, but she said, we're going to be working together. We should get to know each other.
Across our interviews this week, Hortman's leadership approach is emerging as one part of her legacy. Each of the lawmakers we spoke to agree political opponents can have their differences without losing sight of one another's humanity. Plymouth Representative Ginny Cleavorn says she learned from Speaker Hortman.
You can disagree with the argument, but you always have to see the humanity in the individual.
Co-chair of the Public Safety Committee, Representative Kelly Moeller, says gun violence is tied to political violence.
We can't lose sight of what happened and all the gun violence that we've experienced in the state.
Speaker Damoth pointed to the bipartisan mental health and security funding legislation that passed this session.
You can pass laws, but typically the problem we have in Minnesota is criminals don't follow our current laws.
When addressing how to reduce political violence, all three lawmakers returned to the same place. It's not agreement at any cost, but respect above all. For North Star Stories, I'm Tracy Collier.
That concludes our special series marking 1 year since the assassination of Melissa Hortman and examining how her life, her work, and her death have changed our state forever. The same day Melissa and Mark Hortman were killed, prosecutors say a St. Paul man posted YouTube videos threatening now St. Paul Mayor and then State Representative Kalee Herr. This week, the Hennepin County Attorney's Office charged Pau Her Lee with felony threats of violence. Court documents say the videos included an image of her and Hortman with bullet holes in their heads. Lee later told investigators he did not intend to harm anyone and that he posted the videos to be funny. He's due in court July 10th. A tense night last night for people living in St. Peter, just outside of Mankato. The Wright County Sheriff's Office issued a shelter-in-place warning around 10:15. According to unconfirmed scanner traffic, a suspect shot and injured a St. Peter police officer. We'll have an update on the story in our next newscast. People living in the Waconia area have been dealing with ongoing phone service outages, and now a Minnesota lawmaker is stepping in to help. Representative Jim Nash is serving as a district liaison between those impacted by the outages and CenturyLink. He's especially concerned about older adults who rely on landlines for life alert systems that use landlines rather than cell phones. Representative Nash is asking that anyone impacted by the CenturyLink outages contact him directly. And finally, today is Juneteenth, which marks the day in 1865 when enslaved people in Galveston, Texas learned they were free. Governor Walz declared Juneteenth a state holiday 3 years ago. Across the state, people are celebrating with community events, family, and music, including in St. Paul's Rondo neighborhood and Duluth and Mankato, while St. Cloud hosts its 30th annual Juneteenth celebration at Eastman Park. For North Star Stories, I'm Zan Holston.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered. From NPR News, I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The U.S. men's national soccer team defeated Australia at the World Cup today. In a raucous game played in Seattle, the Americans won 2-0. That victory also assures the U.S. team will advance to the knockout round later this month. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan was at that raucous game. She joins us now from outside the stadium. Hey, Beck.
Hello, I'm sure you can tell that that's where I am right now.
Yes, you sound like you're somewhere outside a stadium, and I am insanely jealous. Tell me more about the game.
Yeah, you know what? There was a lot of hype for this game because much had been made before the match of the quality of this Australian team. They had shocked Turkey 2-0 in their first game of this World Cup, and so the U.S. was saying that they were taking this opponent really seriously, but it was the Americans who controlled the match really from the get-go. They scored in the 11th minute on an own goal that came out of this aggressive run by the U.S. forward, Falarin Balogun. They added another goal just before halftime. That was when the defender, Alex Freeman, knocked in a header. You know, Australia just really had no answers. The U.S. was able to play more defensively in the second half. They shut them out. And just, you know, a tremendous performance, this continuation of this really fluid offense that we'd seen from the U.S. in the first game. They now have 6 total goals in this World Cup, which is nothing to sneeze at, and really sets them up well for the final group stage match, which is next Thursday.
Well, and this performance today feels particularly remarkable because the U.S. team was down their biggest star, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's Christian Pulisic. That's their left winger. He is, you know, I think a lot of people would agree, the best player on the team. He is the active all-time leading scorer for the U.S. He has had a nagging injury, though, to his left calf that was exacerbated in the game last week against Paraguay when he was kicked in the leg by a Paraguayan player. Had to come out at halftime. And so all week he'd been training individually instead of with the team, but it still really wasn't clear how serious the injury was. Unfortunately, we now see that it was pretty serious. I mean, if you can't play a game in the World Cup, that's serious, and it's a huge deal, obviously, because he's a key contributor. They made it through this game, but I'm sure all of those guys are hoping he'll be back next week.
Yeah, so that must raise some big question marks for the team moving forward. You said that the next big game is against Turkey. How are they going to look if he can't play?
Yeah, so what they did today is they started in his place a forward named Ricardo Pepi. He is making his World Cup debut this summer, and they looked good, I gotta say. I mean, so Ricardo Pepi was playing up on that left side. They were able to move the ball up well without him. You had players like Anthony Robinson, Ricardo Pepi, Weston McKennie, Malik Tillman, who are all instrumental in getting the ball upward, moving it up, creating those chances up at the top that Pulisic is so central to. That said, Turkey theoretically has more talent on paper than Australia. They have some really good players in Europe's top leagues. So they'll want Pulisic back, that's for sure.
We can still hear a little bit of the raucousness unfolding behind you. Just tell me more about the home atmosphere at this game.
I mean, this is in Seattle. This is a big-time soccer town. They're consistently among the highest attendance for teams in the MLS. And they play the game at the NFL stadium, Lumen Field. It's right near downtown. It's an insane environment. And so no surprise it really showed out. The attendance announced during the game was 66,925. That, of course, was a sellout. Most of those were U.S. fans cheering very hard a lot in that first half. But there was also a really good crowd of Australians who were singing Waltzing Matilda early in the game. So you have to love that. I think with the U.S. headed back to L.A. next week, we'll see more of the same there.
All right. That's NPR's Becky Sullivan in Seattle, where the U.S. team is celebrating a 2-0 win. Thank you, Becky.
Of course. Thank you.
If you have today off for Juneteenth, you may want to say thank you to Opal Lee. To establish today as a federal holiday commemorating the true end of slavery in the United States, she and other activists campaigned for years. And part of Lee's activism took the form of a walk, a very, very long walk from her home in Fort Worth, Texas, all the way to Washington, D.C. That is 1,400 miles. And when she did it in 2016, she was 89 years old, walking 2.5 miles a day. When Opal Lee and I spoke a couple of years ago, I asked about the significance of those 2.5 miles.
2.5, it represented 2.5 years that the enslaved didn't know they were free until General Gordon Granger made his way to Galveston, and he read what's known as General Order Number 3 that said all enslaved are free. Well, he took that and nailed it to the door of what's now Reedy Chapel African Methodist Episcopal Church. And when the enslaved came in from their work and somebody read that to them, they started celebrating, and we've been celebrating ever since.
I am doing the math. Walking 2.5 miles a day for a distance of 1,400 miles, that's well over a year. It's more than 500 days it took you.
Well, I sort of figured somebody would give me a ride along the way.
Did people open up their homes to you along the way? Where'd you stay?
Oh, they did. They did. I tell you, I didn't have anybody that was negative. And people joined in the walk with me. I had one fella that I tried to give a flyer to. He brushed it aside. I decided he was late for work, so I didn't hold it against him.
Mm-hmm. But other people were walking along just there with you?
Yes, they were. From town to town. And if I left September 2016, I actually got to Washington January 2017. And President Obama wasn't there. I didn't get to talk to him. But do you know, we garnered 1,500,000 signatures. Mm-hmm. And we took that to Congress, and we were invited to the White House to see President Biden sign Juneteenth into law. Oh, I was a happy camper. I tell you, I could have done a holy dance, but the kids say when I try, I'm twerking.
I can picture you, how happy you must have been. So what does activism look like for you today?
I'm going to keep on walking and talking because of the disparities that we have, and hope that somebody does something about it. To be a whole people, to be one people, is a goal that hasn't been realized yet. I want to be here when it happens.
That is Opal Lee. Today, as she nears her 100th birthday, her friends, family, and supporters celebrated Juneteenth with another 2.5 miles through Fort Worth. Opal Lee's memoir, A Committee of One, is out now. Happy Friday, happy Juneteenth, and thanks for listening to All Things Considered.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Paramount Plus with The Agency, a political espionage thriller starring Michael Fassbender, Jeffrey Wright, Jodie Turner-Smith, and Richard Gere. All episodes of The Agency streaming June 21st on Paramount Plus. From the Andrew Carnegie Foundation, formerly Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. And from Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker, celebrating 50 years of People Power Radio in northern Minnesota. Join us at KAXE.org. Support comes from Watermark Arts Center in downtown Bemidji, featuring rotating work from Bemidji State University's print and ceramics collections. The center is accessible and open to all. More at watermarkartscenter.org. There's a hands-on watercraft certification class in Grand Rapids for those ages 12 to 17 on Wednesday, July 1st. Pre-register by calling the Grand Rapids DNR office by June 26. Extensive pre-classroom work needs to be completed before the July 1st class. The Minnesota Board on Aging invites residents ages 60 and older to take a survey to help improve statewide aging services. The survey is open through July 15th. Search for Minnesota Board on Aging online to find a link.
The U.S. is clashing